The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Interestingly enough, I think he's a throwback to the 17th century English kings. He is, unlike Bill Clinton, he has had no respect for the ordinary pardon process. He seems to regard pardoning as an intensely political and even a theatrical exercise. Probably all of his grants have some precedent in history. Even the ones that appear most irregular, reaching into ongoing cases, that kind of thing, cutting short prosecutions, that's been done before. What hasn't been done before is almost complete, as you showed pretty convincingly, in my opinion, an almost complete bypassing of the kind of ordinary process that regular people have access to. And that's what really sets Trump apart, that his pardon grants are really intensely personal, and he doesn't want advice really about them. He likes to do them himself, and it is a theatrical kind of a pardoning that we have never seen before.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 5th, 2021. I sat down with Margaret Love, the United States pardon attorney in the Justice Department from 1990 to 1997. We discussed Donald Trump's very controversial pattern of pardons and commutations, Trump's circumvention of the traditional pardon attorney process, and the historical operation of that process prior to Trump. We also discussed various potential reforms of the process for determining pardons and commutations. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 5th, the role of the pardon attorney. In the last few weeks, President Donald Trump has issued a number of very controversial pardons and commutations, including for Roger Stone, for Michael Flynn, and for his son-in-law's father. And it's been widely noted that throughout the Trump presidency, Trump has issued these and other controversial pardons, usually by circumventing a process that's set up in the Justice Department and that's located in an office called the Office of the Pardon Attorney. And Trump has basically ignored that process and set up his own system inside the White House. So to talk about the significance of what Trump has done and to help understand what this pardon attorney's office is, we're very fortunate to have Margaret Love, who was the U.S. pardon attorney from 1990 to 1997, and who now represents applicants for presidential clemency. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Jack. Thanks for asking me.
So let's start off with some basics. What is the pardon power? And can you just explain the terms clemency, pardon, and commutation? These get used a lot without people fully understanding what they mean.
Sure. The framers of the Constitution included a power to pardon in Article 2 of the Constitution. And it is probably the only unlimited, undelegable power of the president. In all of his powers, it is a broad power to dispense basically with the law in appropriate cases when the president considers it appropriate, both to curtail punishment in individual cases. And also Alexander Hamilton, who wrote about the pardon power in Federalist 74, thought it was a very useful thing to quell civil strife, to talked about seasons of insurrection. And indeed, one of the earliest grants was to the farmers of Western Pennsylvania when Washington went out to issue a broad pardon and put down the rebellion. So the terms, executive clemency is the umbrella broad term that covers all of the different types of grants of pardon. It's a little confusing since the word pardon is used both to describe the overall power and also to describe particular grants. Two basic kinds of clemency are used today. One is a sentence commutation, which shortens a prison term. And the other is a full pardon after service of sentence. Now, those terms come out of the Justice Department regulations. So a full pardon, as we've seen from some of President Trump's grants, need not be, quote, after service of sentence, but it can come at any time. So those are the three basic terms, pardon, commutation, and executive clemency.
Okay, so you were the pardon attorney for 7 years, as I said, from 1990 to 1997. What is this office? What is its proper role? What does it do in normal times?
Well, the Office of the Pardon Attorney was established in the 19th century at the time of the Civil War, when the Attorney General decided that President Lincoln had too soft a heart and had to take control of his boss. And the Attorney General then declared that all applicants for pardon would come through him. And that was the beginning of the system that we still have now, at least on paper, where the Attorney General, assisted by the pardon attorney, investigates and makes recommendations to the president on, theoretically at least, all applications for pardon or commutation. Until quite recently, that system worked very well. And even though it was housed in the Department of Justice, the fact is that the Attorney General wears two hats. And the hat that he wore to advise the president was not his hat as chief law enforcement officer, but rather a member of the president's cabinet. So the system worked very well until basically Bill Clinton's administration, when things basically fell apart.
Well, let me ask you a few questions before we get to the Clinton administration. So first of all, I didn't actually know the full story about Lincoln, but the way you described it, as his attorney general basically wrenching the pardon power from Lincoln. But obviously Lincoln must have acquiesced in that. I mean, this is a presidential power, and Lincoln must have gone along with having the initial applications go to the Justice Department, I assume.
Yes. And well, actually, at that time, there was no Justice Department.
Right, of course. That's right.
Right.
That's
right. And as you, yeah. I know you will
right.
know.
Yeah, that was a mistake.
No. It's interesting because 1870 was when the department was founded. The pardon attorney and whatever staff the pardon attorney had at that time, which was not very great, never was very great, was sort of wrapped into the fabric of the Justice Department as a special advisor to the Attorney General for the specific purpose of making recommendations to the president. And yes, every president up until Bill Clinton, and really even including Bill Clinton, has respected the role that the Attorney General played.
I mean, you can imagine the president has this extraordinary power to set aside sentences and to relieve criminal liability. You can imagine a president being just inundated from all quarters with requests for these things. So in part, I assume that in part, one of the reasons that it was thought to be a good idea to shift the application process to the Attorney General was to keep the president out of that stage, hopefully maybe even keep the president out of controversy, but also to stop the White House from being overrun and to try to regularize the system a little bit. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, Lincoln famously would be besieged by the mothers of soldiers who were about to be shot. And he had such, as I said, such a soft heart that he would intercede, and the generals were having a hard time waging their war with all these interventions. So in any event, yes, this was an administrative setup. It also recognized something rather special, I think, about the American experiment with pardon, which is that the pardon power was by virtue really of the Attorney General's role, it was incorporated right into the legal system, and it had a very operational role really until the 1920s, when there was no other way of reducing prison sentences. At that time, parole came into effect, but before then, it was a very crude justice system in the 19th century. No appeals, very few defenses, like duress, insanity, youth. So the pardon power had a really operational role, and there were hundreds of pardons and sentence commutations granted every year.
And so tell us how, in an ideal world, just in an ideal system, how does this process work? You were, when it was working best under your supervision, just give the listener a sense of what the process looks like.
Well, it was a pretty simple process. A person who was interested in applying for clemency would file an application with the Office of the Pardon Attorney. The pardon attorney would take a look at the issues in the case. If it was a sentence commutation, you'd look at what sentence was imposed. They're very general standards. Was the sentence too severe under the circumstances? Are there mitigating circumstances that weren't considered? And then would draft a recommendation. The recommendation after the Reagan administration, the recommendation went to the Deputy Attorney General as opposed to the Attorney General. That was a big change, and it was a very significant change in the way the power inside the department worked. Full pardons, generally, as I said, the after service of sentence, the idea under the Justice Department regulations was that someone should have fully served their sentence, been repentant for their crime, return to the community, become a model citizen with the respect of the community, and would then apply for a pardon. The pardon effectively would eliminate all of the legal collateral consequences of the conviction and would also signify the person's good character as sort of attested to by the president personally.
Okay, so what is the relationship between your office and, you said, as you said, the pardon attorney had a relationship with the White House through the Deputy Attorney General, but what is the kind of reality of the relationship to the White House? It's just to be clear for the listener, the president is not in any way bound by your recommendations. The president doesn't need a recommendation from the pardon attorney. Gerald Ford didn't seek the advice of the pardon attorney when he pardoned Richard Nixon. And I would say that some of the more controversial ones and ones where the president intercedes for policy reasons or on a quick basis to issue a pardon or commutation tends to circumvent or ignore or not seek the advice of the pardon attorney. Could you just talk about, you know, there's the regular course of business and then there are the special cases. Is that fair?
Yeah, but you should know that until Bill Clinton's term, the special cases, as you say, that did not come through the Office of the Pardon Attorney could be counted on the fingers of one hand. The two pardons that President Reagan gave to the FBI officials that were being prosecuted for civil rights violations, the Iran-Contra pardons that George H.W. Bush did at the end of his term, those did not go through the Pardon Attorney's office. But really, almost every other pardon to an individual, I'm not talking about amnesties, that kind of thing, but even those were done with the advice of the pardon attorney. So even the controversial ones, I remember a couple of very controversial cases that we worked on were the Jonathan Pollard case, the Leonard Peltier case, and other pretty high profile cases that we looked at and wrote up full reports on for the White House. Frequently, the White House would actually ask us about a case independent of someone filing an application, the FALN Puerto Rican terrorist cases. They never filed applications. And if the White House was interested in a case, they would phone up, and that happened in the George H.W. Bush administration in the early Clinton years. You'd really get a call and they'd want to know about a particular case. Someone had been importuning them and they wanted to know about it. And we would be contacted.
And then you would give your views if they asked, basically.
Sure, if they asked, absolutely. First, we do just a write-up of the facts.
You mean the facts of the case, the sentences served, all the facts that you knew about what happened if the person was out of jail and the like?
Sure, right. If they wanted to know about the case, the facts of the case, we would give them a write-up. If they wanted a recommendation, we'd add that too.
So your time as pardon attorney bridged the last couple of years of the George H.W. Bush administration into the first...
5 years, actually, of Clinton.
5 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then 5 years of Clinton. So what was the view? So I just want to reiterate something you said. At the end of his administration, George H.W. Bush controversially pardoned Caspar Weinberger and some of the other Iran-Contra defendants. Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel, suggested that it may have been part of a cover-up. It was a controversial pardon. How did that look from your end of things? You weren't consulted on that, were you?
No, I got a call 3 hours before the grants hit the media from then Attorney General Bill Barr, and he told me what was going to happen. But we had nothing to do with those cases. And by the way, I did forget the most important case that never went through the pardon attorney's office, which was the pardon of Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Right. So you've said a couple of times that things changed in the Clinton administration. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah. What changed in the Clinton administration, if you look at the statistics, you'll see that 4 out of the first 5 years of Clinton's 2 terms, there were no pardons, there were no grants of any sort. That was unprecedented. And I've always thought that the blame for Clinton's sort of ignoring his pardon power was equally granted to, whatever you do with blame, to the Justice Department and to the White House. The Justice Department, part of the Justice Department's responsibility to the president was to keep him out of trouble, both in particular cases, but also in a larger sense of sort of not taking care to use the power in a way that was going to make it easier for him to do what he wanted when he wanted. And that, of course, came true at the end of his term in the last year when he decided that he had failed to pardon as much as he wanted and decided that Ronald Reagan's record of pardoning was something that he simply had to match. And by that time, I was no longer in the job, which has some importance, I guess. And the department had basically shut the program down. So it was unavailable to give President Clinton the recommendations that he then said he wanted. So that was kind of the background of the train wreck that came at the end of the Clinton administration.
Could you just describe for the listener in general what the train wreck was? And I didn't realize, are you saying, and you can answer this in the course of answering what the train wreck was, are you suggesting that the train wreck was in part caused by the fact that the pardon attorney's office had shut down by the end of the Clinton administration?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. In fact, if I had to assign responsibility, I would say that the blame was more with the Justice Department than it was with the White House, because the Justice Department did not warn President Clinton that if he did not pursue a regular practice of pardoning all through his term, the way his predecessors had done, that he was going to get to the end of his term and have a very poor record. But I think what the Justice Department got from that, and it sort of suited its own proclivities, was that the president was not interested, and therefore it was not going to really do much work to produce pardon cases.
But the pardons at the end were... They were very controversial. I don't remember all of them, but there was Mark Rich, the fugitive from justice, whose wife had allegedly given a lot of money to the Clinton library. There was the president's brother-in-law.
His brother, yeah.
His brother. There was the Iran-Contra figure, Susan McDougal, who some people alleged that it was a payoff. There was so much sort of scandal in the air for these late Clinton pardons, most or not all of which didn't look to the Justice Department, that there was a huge congressional hearing. There was bipartisan condemnation. There was a Southern District of New York criminal investigation. So, what happened?
What happened was that the president had his focus on not being the stingiest president in history, which he was on track to be, and decided that without any recommendations from the Justice Department, and in that hearing that you refer to, the then White House counsel, Beth Nolan, testified that when she and one of her colleagues went to the department to find what was going on with the pardon program, they were told that there were only 15 cases that they could recommend to the White House. And Clinton was looking at 409 grants that he wanted to make, so 15 was not going to get him there. So basically what he did was to announce to the world, and there's a lot in the press in the run-up to the end of his administration, that he would pardon anybody who came in that his staff thought was worthy of it. So there were 173 grants on his very final day. And there were a lot of pretty dodgy grants on that day. So that's what happened. The department basically abandoned the president.
Yeah. So that was the dodgiest, in my view, the dodgiest set of clemency grants prior to Trump. I mean, there was just a whole bunch of seemingly corrupt or self-serving pardons.
Right. Irregular.
Irregular. Certainly. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. So I want to get to your proposals for reform and what's going on in the Trump administration. But first, just a general question. There's a standard criticism from progressive criminal justice scholars and sentencing scholars, I guess not even progressive, some conservatives as well, that the pardon attorney and the process and the criteria are too backward-looking, the process is too slow, that we need to have different criteria, that there should be many more pardons, there should be more commutations. President Obama reportedly grew frustrated with the process, and he kind of initiated his own program, of which maybe you can tell us about that. So what do you think about these general criticisms of the pardon attorney process?
I think they missed the mark. I have a very different take on it. I think that there has been no real thoughtful consideration of what the pardon power really ought to be doing in a modern justice system. I think that the fact that pardon is literally the only way that people with federal convictions can reduce their prison sentences is recently, there's been some development in that regard, or deal with the collateral consequences of conviction. Most states have multiple remedies. The feds have one, and that is the pardon power. And I think that there has not been sufficient consideration of whether that really is a flaw in the justice system and whether the law itself really ought to be the focus of attention.
Okay, we'll get to those proposed reforms in a second and what you're talking about more concretely. So what was the Obama Clemency Initiative? And because he issued a couple of thousand sentence reductions, didn't he?
He did, but that was a very strange arrangement there. Let me just backtrack for one second to your earlier question, which was about the process itself. Yes, certainly the process can be improved. But from my point of view, the problem is the respect and status of that process and of the pardon attorney within the department. That's the real problem, not staff or resources or how many people make recommendations or how slow the process is. The respect with which that whole program is held within the department means that the pardon attorney really has no independent voice. And I think that's the real problem there. What happened with Obama was that there was, to my way of thinking, once the president announced that he wanted to consider commuting a number of long drug sentences, the department set up a very odd hybrid quasi-private system of reviewing sentences. And it was tasked out to a number of private organizations, which set up a very complex, unnecessarily complex process that did not produce very many grants. And I mean, there were many other ways that could have been done. It could have been staffed out to the districts to identify people in prison whose sentences were too long. But it wasn't really until the very last year of the Obama term, and when he was gifted with one of the most talented department employees is really a bad word there. Bob Zosmer from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania U.S. Attorney's Office came in to take over the process, and he really saved that program and got 1,700, a total of 1,700 cases that the president did in the end. But it was a pretty clunky process, and it's been established by a sentencing commission report that very few of the grants that were made actually satisfied the criteria that President Obama had set out. So to my way of thinking, it could have been done much more efficiently.
Okay, that brings us, I want to turn to the Trump clemency decisions. There have been 94 altogether. With your sage advice and assistance, Matthew Gluck and I went through all of them last week. And it turns out that the stories have been clear for years now that Trump has been ignoring this process or not interested in this process. He's been had a White House-centered process for deciding who gets commutations. His commutations have been remarkably self-serving in the sense that they're based on insider connections or that they serve some political interest or he saw someone on television. Matthew and I determined that almost two-thirds of them there was not even a petition, relevant petition pending. So just give us your reaction to what Trump has done. What do you make of this?
Interestingly enough, I think he's a throwback to the 17th century English kings. He is, unlike Bill Clinton, he has had no respect for the ordinary pardon process. He seems to regard pardoning as an intensely political and even a theatrical exercise. Probably all of his grants have some precedent in history, even the ones that appear most irregular, reaching into ongoing cases, that kind of thing, cutting short prosecutions. That's been done before. What hasn't been done before is almost complete, as you showed pretty convincingly, in my opinion, an almost complete bypassing of the kind of ordinary process that regular people have access to. And that's what really sets Trump apart, that his pardon grants are really intensely personal, and he doesn't want advice really about them. He likes to do them himself, and it is a theatrical kind of a pardoning that we have never seen before.
And it's, before we turn to possible reforms, it's really a remarkable exercise of power, because if we set aside the possible cases where maybe these pardons were done in exchange for obstruction of justice, some people said that's true of the Stone and Flynn, or certainly the Stone pardon and earlier commutation, or maybe for some bribe or something. If we set those possible cases aside, and even that would be a difficult case to prosecute under current law, these theatrical pardons, as you describe them, that's a great term for them. These are all entirely authorized by the Constitution. They are entailed by this extraordinarily broad power. It's just that Trump has kind of conceptualized that power in a different way.
That's right. And when the framers discussed the power and the limits on it, and understanding that there were no limits and couldn't be no limits under the Constitution, or at least very few, the notion that the president would be constrained by embarrassment of what one of the members of the convention said, that he would be afraid of the damnation of his fame to all future ages, and that would be the constraint on the president's power. But that doesn't seem to be a constraint on President Trump. So, yeah, I mean, it's a odd situation, but.
By the way, that in a nutshell was an assumption, that Trump has exploded, not just in the pardon power context, but in every context with his own violations. I mean, there was a sense of shame or concern about reputation or the like would be a kind of informal constraint on certain extreme abuses of power. And Trump has shown how we can't assume that's the case. Okay, so you wrote a great piece in Lawfare last week entitled "Are Trump's Pardons a Blessing in Disguise?" And these are your ideas for how we should rethink the pardon power. Can you tell us basically what you think?
Sure. Well, as I think I said a little earlier, meant to say that I think that we have relied too heavily on the pardon power to do justice. It's really a bygone age that whose system was so crude that pardon necessarily played a central role. And my feeling is that this is a blessing in that it will create the opportunity to really talk about how pardon has become too much a key way of doing justice, and that we really have to look to the legal system and see whether there are law reforms that would take some of the burden off the pardon power. I'm not saying that I don't think that there could be improvements in the way the power is administered. Absolutely, there can be and should be. But I would let the president pardon as he wishes, but ask Congress to take a serious look at some of the reasons that people apply for pardon and ask questions about whether the law needs to be changed to address those.
So can you be more concrete? You're talking about things like modernizing the parole system and coming up with other avenues and other mechanisms for shortening sentences or relieving sentences that are unjust for various reasons or maybe not proportionate to the crime or whatever the criteria would be.
Right. And in an odd way, we already have. 2 years ago, we passed a law, the First Step Act, that has a provision in it that potentially, if it's interpreted broadly, it could be the way out for many of the long prison sentences. It enables federal prisoners to take their cases back to the sentencing court. This wasn't possible earlier because there was a roadblock in the Justice Department. But now federal prisoners can go back to get their sentences reduced. There are many ways that people with federal convictions that run into collateral consequences, people who have returned from prison or perhaps never went, could get a similar sort of relief, probably through the courts or through an administrative agency. I love to use my example of federal firearms laws because as things stand now, there is no way for a person with a federal conviction to regain the right to hunt, for example, short of a presidential pardon. So as a result, probably I've been told by former staffers that left more recently than I did, that about half the pardon caseload now is composed of people who simply want to go hunting again. And that is certainly borne out by my own clients.
And so this law is 2 years old, isn't it? Do we know how it's worked in practice?
Yeah, we do. It was the law was one that had for years been interpreted by the Justice Department as applying only to terminally ill or very aged prisoners. Now, there's nothing in the law that says anything about age or illness. It simply says that a court can reduce a sentence for, and I'm quoting, extraordinary and compelling reasons. Now, the Sentencing Commission is supposed to say what that means. And right now, we don't have a Sentencing Commission, and the existing policy guidance, again, reflects the age and illness grounds that the Justice Department has always relied on. But there has been a lot of litigation in these 2 years over what that phrase means. And four courts of appeal now have basically said, look, courts are not bound by the age and illness boundaries, and they can release a prisoner, reduce the sentence for any reason that is extraordinary and compelling in their view and that meets other standards for imposing federal sentences.
So that sounds to me like an almost complete substitute power for the president's commutation power. Or at least potentially so.
Yes.
Is it constitutional? I think the answer is yes, but I wanted to know what you think. I mean, does Congress in effect giving the courts the authority to reduce sentences that were imposed without much more, definitive criteria than that? Is there an argument that that impinges on the president's exclusive pardon power?
No more than parole did.
Right.
I mean, we've had this ability to reduce sentences for almost, well, for 100 years now. And that has never been thought to be unconstitutional.
Okay, so that's a great suggestion. But let's set that aside for a second and ask, if the pardon program is left exclusively in the justice, if the commutation process, let me put it differently, the clemency process, including shortening of sentences, is left more or less exclusively with the president, or if we're just focusing on the presidential end of things, how should the current pardon attorney and pardon attorney process be changed, if at all?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing that I would do would be to appoint a person to manage that process that is known to the attorney general and known to the president. I would put the recommending authority back in the office of the attorney general. The problem with delegating it to the deputy's office is that it got strangled there by the views of federal prosecutors. And that was the worst thing about my experience as pardon attorney, is that I had to deal with federal prosecutors who thought that pardon was a threat to their work and did not want to recommend it, even in cases where someone had been long out in the community. So I would put the recommending authority back in the cabinet official, the attorney general, and staff it with people who, a person particularly, who is well known to the attorney general and a close advisor. That's the way it was up to the Jimmy Carter term, but it stopped being that under President Reagan.
Any other suggestions for the Biden administration? Anything about the process? Anything else about the process that needs to be changed, or the substantive criteria, or any responses that are appropriate to what Trump has done? I mean, what other advice would you have for the incoming Biden administration?
Well, without first consideration of the role that they want pardon to play, I think it's kind of hard to talk about criteria. And I'm thinking now not so much of the shortening prison sentences as I am about the full pardons. And the main improvement that I would make, frankly, is one of who manages the program. Not resources, not even standards. I would say who manages the program is the key reform, and who's actually making the recommendation to the president. I mean, if you did those changes, if you made those changes, then I think everything else would fall into place.
Last question. There have been suggestions to amend the pardon power. Once you open it up to an amendment, you can do anything. But some suggestions have been to curtail abuse, to not allow a pardon after a presidential election. A lot of the controversial ones happened during the transition, to not allow one for one's family or for one in which the president has self-interest. I mean, once you open it up, as I say, you can do anything. What do you think about potentially amending Article 2?
Well, Jack, you know, for 150 years, there was no problem, or actually more than 150 years. I'm just thinking of the time in which there was an advisory function in the Justice Department. There was no scandal, and there was no unhappiness on the part of the president with the way he was being served. That changed in the Clinton administration, and it was never fixed in the next two presidencies. And then, of course, once Trump came along, everything changed. But I do think that, I mean, you could look at what state systems do, and many state pardon systems have built into their constitution various checks on the governor's authority. In Delaware, for example, which I think is the most efficient pardon system in the country, they have a high-level advisory board, and they have public hearings in every case, and they make recommendations. It's chaired by the lieutenant governor, and they make recommendations to the governor. And in a little state like Delaware, they do hundreds of pardons every year. And it's a very regular process. But I'm not sure that I would recommend creating a new bureaucracy. I know it's been suggested, it's been advised that we should have a commission to make recommendations to the president. But until we think about what role we want pardon to play, And I think tinkering with the process is really premature.
Margaret, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Jack.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to lawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.